his wheelchair flapping in the breeze, one leg missing and both hands free. No one's paying much mind to him. The VA budget's just stretched so thin, and there's more coming back from the Mideast war. We can't make it here anymore. That big old building was a textile mill. It fed our kids and it paid our bills, but they turned us out and they closed the doors. We can't make it here anymore. You see those pallets piled up on the loading dock? They're just gonna sit there till they rot, 'cause there's nothing to ship, nothing to pack, just busted concrete and rusted tracks. The empty storefronts around the square, there's a needle in the gutter and glass everywhere. You don't come down here unless you're looking to score. We can't make it here anymore. Still open, but man, it's slow. The tip jar's light and the register's low. The bartender don't have much to say. The regular crowd gets thinner each day. Some have maxed out all their credit cards. Some are working two jobs and living in cars. Minimum wage won't pay for a roof, won't pay for a drink. If you gotta have proof, just try it yourself, Mr. CEO. See how far 5:15 an hour will go. Take a part-time job at one of your stores. I bet you can't make it here anymore. In the magazine she found on the floor of the laundromat. A woman with kids can forget all that. If she comes up pregnant, what'll she do? Forget the career, forget about school. Can she live on faith, live on hope? High on Jesus or hooked on dope? When it's way too late to just say no, you can't make it here anymore. Like the ones we made before, except this one came from Singapore. I guess we can't make it here anymore. Should I hate a people for the shade of their skin, or the shape of their eyes, or the shape I'm in? Should I hate them for having our jobs today? No, I hate the men sent the jobs away. I can see them all now, they haunt my dreams, all lily white and squeaky clean.
Hello, welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you by our listener-supported community radio station, WFT, broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois. The views and opinions expressed here are those of speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. And I was James McMurphy doing a song, We Can't Make It Here Anymore, and some great lyrics in that song. It's pretty much... states the what's going on in America as far as people losing their standard of living constantly and everything, and unfortunately we've got a demagogue out there that's running for president that's trying to exploit this pain, this real suffering, but focusing it away from those who are really responsible, trying to blame other victims. Without further ado, Gus, some underwriting announcements for us?
We got a few demagogues that we're going to talk about today.
Okay, yes.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Gospel Justice hosts regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon, Urbana. For more information, visit www.centralillinoisgospeljustice.org. Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. The World Labor Hour is supported in part by listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. The Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio.
Okay, thank you, Gus. Okay, some things have been happening this week, of course, the news. What do you have for us to start off with?
Oh, it's already at that time where the president is showing his Hillary Clinton love again. He's already out there talking craziness and showing that he is in bed with the corporatization that's happening with this country. In the wake of the five losses on Tuesday, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders is coming under mounting pressure from Democratic Party leaders like the president and the media to abandon his presidential campaign and concede to Hillary Clinton. Remarks by Obama to Democratic Party donors at a fundraiser on March 11th in Austin, Texas, were leaked to the New York Times Thursday and confirmed by the White House. Obama called on Democrats to begin uniting behind the party's prospective nominee, which they assumed to be Hillary Clinton. The Times headline went even further than the actual content of Obama's words. Quote, Obama privately tells donors that time is coming to unite behind Hillary Clinton. End quote. As quoted, however, Obama was careful not to name any names so that White House spokesman Josh Earnest could confirm that Obama had discussed the presidential race with Democratic donors while disavowing any explicit preference for Clinton. And the Times reported, quote, in unusually candid remarks, President Obama privately told a group of Democratic donors last Friday that Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont was nearing the point at which his campaign against Hillary Clinton would end and that the party must soon come together to back her, end quote.
Do you think that donors he would be talking to really need to be have that said to them?
Exactly. But you know, exactly. But you know, it's just the
they're fact, already there.
Exactly, they're already there. But you know, it's just the fact that the president is already coming out. I mean, we kind of knew he was going to back Clinton anyway because they both have the same corporatization mentality, the petty bourgeoisie ideology. But it's the fact that he's already trying to create this fissure and bring people against Sanders, you know, like, yeah, we just need to unite against Clinton, you know, like, this is showing that this is who we're going to be about. And like I said, you know, it just shows that just the willingness to be fair and to be honest in what people consider to be the system that they think is working for them. But in fact, it's nothing but shadiness, a bunch of underhandedness and fracturing that goes on. And it proves that the two-party system is nothing but a complete and utter fiasco.
Yeah, so, okay, yeah, we're going to be talking some more about U.S. elections here.
I wanted to lead it off so we can get ready
for
that.
Sure, sure, sure.
Yeah.
Well, I got some election news.
Okay.
I worked 4 days this week.
Okay.
Pouring concrete at a Bayer company that's B-A-Y-E-R, like the aspirin.
Okay.
They got some kind of research facility not too far from my house, and mm-hmm. I hope they're not going to breed some kind of Frankencorn zombies at,
yeah,
like okay. Day of the Triffids. So anyway, I was out there, and I was pleasantly surprised at the attitudes of a lot of my coworkers. As you know, I'm often fairly depressed at the attitudes of my coworkers, but
in the building trades, you know,
yeah,
labor's union, okay.
But there was people there. There's a couple of structural iron workers from probably around the Peoria area, as they had a 309 area code on their truck.
Mm-hmm.
And they were feeling the burn, Dave.
Okay.
And there was other people definitely that voted for Bernie Sanders there besides mm-hmm. them. And I think at certain points I gave them permission to speak.
Oh, really? Okay.
Because they would be talking more conservative things, and I'd say, well, I'm going to vote for Bernie Sanders. And they're like, oh, wow, okay, yeah, you know.
Okay.
And
redirect the conversation and the thoughts. That's good, Bill. That's
yeah,
good.
So anyway, that's from the front lines.
Okay. Well, you know, I got an email a while back from a carpenter I know in New York City. He was talking about the jobs he's been on in New York City area is that you'd see graffiti, either for Trump or for Bernie Sanders. And he said it came down to pretty much is that the people on the job, almost everybody was supporting Bernie Sanders. The ones that weren't tended to be the company foreman, the company, the company kiss yeah. butts, you know, those kind, the backstabbers.
Oh, yeah, the ones who look up to a billionaire.
Correct.
Who, yeah. You know.
Yes, indeed. Okay. Well, I got some interesting news. It might not be news to, too many people, but anyway, everyone in America is even more broke than you think. The massive and growing gulf between rich and poor is one of the dearest challenges facing the U.S. economy. Highlighting this gap, more than half of U.S. wage earners make less than $30,000 a year. That's more than half of U.S. wage, $30,000. And according to analysis released by the Social Security Administration on Tuesday, that's not far above the $27,000 that marked the federal poverty line for a family of five in 2012. We've created this in, you know, in infographic to help visualize, okay, where do you stack up? If you make more than $10,000, you earn more than 24% of the American people, or about 37 million people. If you make more than $15,000, roughly the annual salary of a minimum wage employee working 40 hours a week, you earn more than 32% of Americans. If you make more than $30,000 a year, which is $15 an hour if you work full-time, you earn more than 53% of Americans. $30,000 a year, $15 an hour, if you're working a, you know, a 52 week job. And if you make more than $50,000, you earn more than 73% of the American people. And if you make $100,000 or more, you earn, more than 92.6% of Americans. And you are officially in the top 1% of American wage earners if you earn more than $250,000 a year. Well, that's most, union, national, labor presidents,
we got a story,
you know.
Coming
yeah.
From this, our favorite union.
Okay. No wonder we, well, I won't go into that. Anyway, the 894 people that earn more than $20 million, dollars, 894 people, earn more than $20 million. They make more than 99.99989% of Americans and are compensated a cumulative, okay, I'm going to see if I understand this figure right here, 37,009,979,568 per year. Whoa. Okay, and this is based on 153 million American wagers as defined by the Social Security Administration. So, yeah. Gus, I know you go into this, your monthly jobs report and some other things, but I don't know, this seemed to break it down in very, very realistic terms. I mean,
yeah,
it's like, wow.
We can't even discuss this idea of a middle class anymore. I mean, it's at the point now where you have a working class and a sub-working class. I mean, it's at the point where 33% of the country make wages that are below the poverty line or right at the poverty line. That's a one-third of the population. The rest of them are just a little bit above it. So again, we can't even talk about this idea, you know, because, you know, the politicians love to use the term middle class.
Sure.
And the shrinking of the middle class,
yeah.
The disappearance. I'm going to improve the middle class. There is no more middle class. You have a very small few of working class people who are upper working class strata,
mm-hmm.
but they're still making very poor wages and they're seeking to ascend to that next class level, but they're still working class.
Sure.
There is no more middle class anymore. So like I said, that's why we gotta really look at it, and I'm glad you brought that data in, because it's so critical for people to see that this is class warfare at this
yeah.
point.
And they keep saying we're broke, you know, we're broke, but yet, you know, it's not a matter, we don't have a budget problem either at the state or the national level. We have a revenue problem. Basically, they're
exactly.
allocating the money where it shouldn't be going and not where it needs to go.
Well, yeah, that's like I was talking to somebody on this job the other day. There's a guy there, a finisher, who's sort of a libertarian bent,
mm-hmm.
but he was easy to talk to, and, well, I was talking to him about the inheritance tax.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, they think, well, what is the limit now? Like $4 million or $6 million or something?
I'm not sure, yeah.
But that is one of the problems there. And then you explained to him about how when Eisenhower was president, the top marginal tax rate was 92%, and that there was about 30 tax brackets, and is much more fair. And as long as we're talking about money, folks, and just in case you might need a tax deduction, you should call up and pledge to WEFT
yes.
at 217-359-9000. 1-800-332-3338. And at the $90.10 level, you can get an American-made T-shirt with a wonderful design on it. And I believe these headphones here that say Listen Local, Weft, has our logo on the sides of it.
Mm-hmm.
So you can show that off.
Okay.
And
you can use them if you want. If you donate to WEFT, a minimum of $40, you can actually be a member of WEFT, which, you know, entitles you to vote for the board of directors, and also take the airshifter training and have your own program. So those headphones could come in handy for your program if you'd like.
Yeah, and by the way, Dave, that was exactly what I was thinking today.
Okay.
Remember, a lot of times these kind of fundraisers are called membership drives.
Mm-hmm.
And what we would rather have is a lot of members.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we want to do the Bernie Sanders model than the Hillary Clinton model.
Okay, well put.
And we definitely don't have any way to do the Donald Trump.
No, not Trump, that we would Trump
model. And what I'm calling out, I want to call out some people in Piatt County. What's going on? Let's hear from you. Bement, Monticello.
This will be Radio Free Piatt County.
Yes, and how about some of the trades out there? Are there any laborers listening? John, are you listening? Are there any carpenters listening? Any iron workers? Any plumbers? Pipe fitters? You know, are there any, building service workers at the U of I listening? SEIU members? And so on and so forth. I believe they could do that, community shares where things are automatically taken out of their paycheck, man. Mm-hmm. That makes it pretty painless.
Indeed.
But anyway, call 359-9338 or go to our website and click on the donate button.
Okay. You know, you just reminded me, I guess, was earlier in the week, I guess there was an overturn, an election, that voted out an incumbent, business agent for the plumbers union.
Really?
Yeah. So Matt Langendorf's no longer the business agent, and the new business agent for the, plumbers union locally here is, Matt Kelly, who's the current president of the AFL-CIO.
Really?
Oh, well,
yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it was, it was an interesting, upset. Most of the members, that I talked to were really surprised it happened, evidently, there's some things going on that, members were unhappy about, and they wanted a little change, so they did it. And that's the nice thing about the plumbers is that we don't have that option in the carpenters. Our BAs are appointed by a district council that's subservient to our national president who makes $650,000 or more a year. And
well, Dave,
so
you know
so
the
forth.
System at the laborers is that your business agent retires during their term so that the executive board gets to select whoever they want to be the business agent, then that person has the advantage of incumbency.
But you still get to vote on them, though.
You still get to vote on them, but it's actually,
sure.
mean, Dave, you know, voting does not equal democracy.
Yeah, but when you don't have it.
It's, it's a necessary but insufficient condition.
Okay, Gus, what else do we have, for the news?
Well, the UAW is back in the news again.
Okay.
Negotiating more austerity for rank and file members of, you know, the auto workers. Officials of the UAW have confirmed that the union is in preliminary stage of talks with automobile seat maker Lear Corporation over lower pay rates for new hires the company plans to bring into the city of Detroit. Detroit, of course. The company says it wants to expand operations in the city based on extorting municipal tax breaks and concessions. The latest move by Lear continues the relentless assault on U.S. manufacturing wages aided and abetted by the trade union leaders like Dennis Williams. It follows the 2015 contract settlement between the UAW and the Detroit-based car makers that saw the continuation of the two-tier wage system and pay increases below the rate of inflation. Lear wants to create 500 to 1,000 union-represented manufacturing jobs in the city of Detroit at a lower pay scale than workers at other UAW organized facilities. According to a report in Crain's Detroit Business, Lear CEO Matt Simoncini, however you say his last name, is looking at a pay rate, quote, in the mid-teens with some benefits, end quote.
With mid-teens?
Mid-teens.
Oh, you mean the minimum wage that we're looking for?
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's the way it is at Caterpillar now. Mm-hmm. I don't think you make that much starting out. They're too set, you know, lower tier, but I'm not.
Yeah, a lot of locals in the UAW fought that, including the one in Decatur with Larry Solomon.
I mean, no, the president. Yeah, that is the biggest thing ever for the UAW is
that's hurt
two-tier.
The members, yes.
Well, I mean, just in their pride and their principles.
Yeah, and it divides the older members with seniority against the younger ones. And of course, once the older ones are gone, everyone's going to be getting the lower tier. You know, you can see that coming.
Right.
And again, this proves just the fact you give them a finger, they want a hand. You know, this is just like last year, the UAW leadership, Dennis Williams, had to hire a public relations firm to try to sell a crappy contract to their members.
A really bad.
I mean, that has to be a first. I mean, for sure. And it's sad because the, you know, the United Auto Workers, that used to be back in the 1930s, all the way up through probably into the 80s, but especially in the 1930s, that was a very militant democratic union. They were the ones that, occupied factories, you know, to get recognition, you know, and, did all sorts. And they were one of the first unions along with the West Coast longshoremen, that took in a lot of African American workers, and they weren't excluding them and, you know, trying to discourage them like a lot of other unions were, except for the IWW, of course, you know, but.
It's really an interesting history going, like you said, going back to the 30s to now and looking at the transformation of the power of the UAW and the kind of things. I mean, you really saw rank and file running a lot of the operations of the UAW going into the first 30, 40 years. But then, like Bill always points to, that late 1970s, early 1980s period, when you saw the corporatization and privatization come in heavily, you start hearing this idea of a budget cut.
Teamwork.
Yeah. Exactly. You start seeing that stuff.
Yeah, you give all your shortcuts up that to the management to streamline their production.
Yeah.
And there's an amazing book called Rivethead by Ben Hamper that was written during the early 1980s. Ben Hamper used to write for Mother Jones magazine. He's a friend of Michael Moore's. It's kind of interesting to look up at how they shortened things where basically two guys, and it's guys back then, could split up a shift where one of them could just leave for half the day and the other one cover for them.
Mm-hmm. But instead of lightening the workload, what this did was lead to job losses.
But right there, they actually had their own that they created 4-hour day.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. Okay. Well, so, we're going to take a quick music break and be right back. You're listening to the World Labor Hour, the supported community radio station WFT broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois. Be right back. Okay, we're back. That was Patti Smith. People Have the Power. Some quick public service announcements. Tune in today from 2 to 3 p.m. And every Saturday for None Other Sports Show hosted by fellow worker Neil Parthen. Some 2 to 3 on 104.5 FM WRFU. And you can also get it online at noneothersportsshow.org. And let you know, too, that tomorrow and every Sunday from 4 to 5 p.m. is Labor's Worldview TV. And this Sunday is the videotape of the Jill Stein speech when she was in Champaign on Wednesday, March 2nd, and let you know a couple of other upcoming programs. A week from this Sunday, is going to be, a program about the Chicago elections and police and their unions. This is out from Labor Beat in Chicago. And, then, on April 3rd, Sunday, April 3rd, we're going to be, showing a film called Education Incorporated, which is about a battle in two different school districts, in the Denver, Colorado area, to basically unseat some Koch brothers-backed Tea Party Republican candidates that tried to run the public school system into the ground so that they could privatize it. And really good film. So anyway, I want to go now to our guest who's here in the studio. Could you introduce yourself to the listeners, please?
Hi, thanks, Dave. My name's Deborah Schreishoon. I'm a national staffer with Progressive Democrats of America. And for the last 2 years, we've been working to get Bernie Sanders elected president of the United States.
Okay, now, if I'm not mistaken, this actually, there was sort of a draft Bernie campaign. And how long ago did that start?
Actually, it started in 2013.
Wow, okay.
Our executive director, mm-hmm. Tim Carpenter, is from Massachusetts, and so he went and had a conversation with Senator Elizabeth Warren,
mm-hmm.
and she made it clear to him that she had no intention of running for president. Unfortunately, of course, Move On and other organizations somehow didn't have a conversation with her. But anyway, so once he realized that she was not willing to run for president, he talked to Bernie Sanders, who had some interest in the subject. And he talked to Bernie several times. A number of people talked to Bernie. Tim was advocating for Bernie to run as a Democrat so that he could get more airtime for his views, and which are, you know, obviously progressive views. And in very early 2014, we started our Run Bernie Run campaign. In April, late April, unfortunately, Tim Carpenter died, but we were planning our 10-year anniversary. And Bernie Sanders came to our anniversary celebration in Massachusetts in May and spoke to us. We presented him at that time with over 12,000 signatures urging him to run for president as a Democrat.
Okay.
And then as soon as that started taking off, suddenly Run Warren Run started up.
Okay. And so listeners, so they know that Bernie Sanders is, well, first he was mayor of Burlington, Vermont, the major city in Vermont. Then he got elected to the, U.S. House of Representatives and then, later, the U.S. Senate. And, he's listed as an independent. Actually, he's a socialist and he runs as a socialist, but, you know, in the corporate media, they don't want to mention that word, you know, so they indicate him as an independent.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think it's really interesting because, before he ran for president, he wouldn't come out and say that he was a socialist in the mainstream media.
Correct. Yes.
Either.
Yes.
And so I don't know. I just find this really an interesting cultural moment, if anything.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Bernie was one of the founders of the Congressional Progressive Caucus.
Oh, he was.
And,
oh, okay.
And still is the only Senate member of the Congressional
He's
Caucus.
He's the only Senate member?
Yes.
Whoa. Okay. Wow. That's worse than I thought. Okay. And I'm pretty cynical. Okay. So then, basically then, okay. So about mid, summer of 2014 is really kind of when the Sanders, presidential
yes.
campaign kind of started, at least slowly.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And so as I said, Progressive Democrats of America was the first national organization to endorse Bernie. And we go back, as I said, to 2013 and, monthly organizing calls throughout 2014 until we maxed out to the Bernie campaign in financial contributions, which was like $5,000, I think.
Mm-hmm.
He would join our monthly organizing calls and speak to our members, and we did a lot of organizing work on the ground, pushing people toward his events and working with his campaign. Since that time, because of the FEC rules, and Progressive Democrats of America is a PAC, mm-hmm. A political action committee, so we've been working independently. We have members and people working for Bernie in every state in the union. We were organized on Puerto Rico before the primary there. So we've really been organizing, you know, and now, of course, we're following the primary trail. And this weekend we're working on Arizona, Idaho, and Utah.
Okay. All right. So why do you like Bernie Sanders?
He's honest and consistent, and he says what he thinks, and mm-hmm. his political views are those that I share.
Okay. Specifically what issues? Go ahead, Bill.
Well, I was just going to say, as far as saying what he thinks, that is true. He thinks. Donald Trump just says whatever pops into his head at any moment.
Yeah, but specifically.
But everybody says that about Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Oh, that's why I like it, because he says what he thinks.
Yeah. You know, when he spoke in May at our 10th anniversary mm-hmm. Celebration, he had an interview with John Nichols on Friday evening, and then he gave a speech on Saturday. And I was thinking, well, I've already heard him Friday evening. I don't need to hear him Saturday because it's probably going to be the same thing. Totally different. Totally different. Totally sincere. The issues, I really appreciate that he says that climate change is our number one problem, because it is. I appreciate that he has been at the forefront of trying to get single-payer health care for the United States of America. I appreciate that he has been fighting for civil rights and equal rights since the 1960s. He got arrested in Chicago trying to help desegregate student housing. He gets on the picket line with workers. He's been against the trade deal, the international so-called free trade.
Yeah, like NAFTA, now the upcoming Trans-Pacific Partnership.
He was, you know, unequivocally opposed to the Keystone XL pipeline. He didn't have to evolve on that issue. He's supported gay rights. He's been at the forefront on raising the minimum wage, and he doesn't do the namby-pamby, well, we could raise it a little bit here or maybe a little bit there. No, he says, well, we need $15 an hour now. So that's why I like Bernie Sanders.
Okay.
Man, that's a list. Maybe we should have asked what you don't like.
That would have been a short list.
They're probably, very short list. That's impressive with somebody, and somebody who's been consistent about these things. No running to the left in the primaries.
And then lunging to the right once elected.
That's true.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing about Bernie Sanders is that, he's got a verifiable track record that goes back to the 1980s, early 1980s, mm-hmm. And, it's interesting, tactically. I mean, I'm going to have to, make an opinion here. And that is that I think he made the right decision to run as a Democrat, for specifically of why you guys said he should, or, Mr. Carpenter said he should. It was in order to get corporate media attention, because otherwise he'd be completely ignored and blocked out like they do to Jill Stein or whoever else runs as a third party candidate. But even then, I mean, the media coverage of him has been, I mean, horrible. I mean, as far as the amount of time they give to him,
minimalist.
That's a good term compared to Hillary Clinton or especially Donald Trump.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. Last Tuesday, he addressed a group of people, supporters, in Phoenix, Arizona, and the talking heads were going on and on about the horse race, and no cable channel, no network channel even broke in to give a soundbite from his speech.
Oh, yeah, but they'd take a call from Donald Trump anytime.
Exactly.
And that's all of the networks, pretty much, all of the news networks, not just Fox or somebody.
Yeah, I mean, I noticed that when I've told this story many, many times.
You know what that means, Dave?
What's that?
That means community radio is just that more important than it was in the past.
Oh, indeed.
So please call 359-9338 and make a generous pledge.
Indeed.
All you radicals, I hear there's radicals in White Heath.
Oh, okay.
We need to hear from you.
Okay, all right.
So, that's you, Sheila and Mark.
Oh, okay. Yeah. We're calling out some people by name. Okay.
I think I might know them.
Okay. So, yeah, I took my my wife to the doctor's, office, back right before Christmas, and I took a book with me and everything, and while she was in there, of course, they had these television monitors in a huge waiting room, and I tried to get as far away as I could, but I couldn't help but still hear the sound pretty well. And I know in that 20 minutes I was there, I heard, Donald Trump's name mentioned at least 60 or 70 times in 20 minutes. I heard Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton, and Barack Obama's names mentioned about maybe, you know, 6 or 8 times, each. And I didn't hear Bernie Sanders' name mentioned once, even though they were talking about the upcoming New Hampshire primaries and how Hillary Clinton was behind her opponent. That's how they said, her opponent. He didn't even mention his name, you know. And I mean, this is just, you know, I avoid corporate media like the plague, because I think it's harmful, frankly. And, you know, the few times, this is like one of the few times I was exposed to it. And it's like, that must be Fox News. I got up and walked over to the monitor. No, it's MSNBC.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, just that little 20-minute experience I had, you know, shows me, I mean, so, you know, and this whole, you know, how the media, you compare that with how the corporate media has basically created Donald Trump, I mean, basically out of nothing, you know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's just like, this is quite interesting. I mean, you know, this whole phenomenon of our corporate media, you know, like Bill says, why community radio stations are important, but it's also, you know, we got to start maybe reconsidering how we have our meatiness. Cause, you know, they used to talk about, you know, during the Cold War when we were growing up about how, oh, it's so bad in, you know, Russia and Cuba because there's only one state media and you only hear one side. Well, what do we have now?
Well,
you know, you think about it.
Always also the idea, too, that the people in Russia and Cuba knew that there was only one state media, so they took everything with a real big grain of salt.
Yeah, they didn't.
Whereas Americans
believe everything they hear or see for the most part, yeah.
Yeah, if you look at some statistics on how many people don't believe in evolution and things like that. That's
yeah.
Sure.
But anyway, getting back to Bernie's campaign, I mean, he did, for you listeners who aren't aware, Bernie Sanders here in the recent Illinois primary on Tuesday, lost the state of Illinois, but he won like 85% or close to, yeah, about, I'd say between 80 and 90% of the counties in Illinois. Where he lost was up in Chicago big time and a few other scattered counties around the state, but he won Champaign County by 2-1 margin, 67-33%. 67% for Bernie Sanders, 33 for Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, and you said he won Piatt too, didn't you?
It looks like Piatt. It looks like, I don't know, he may have lost McLean County, though, over in Decatur. The map didn't really label the states.
He lost Vermilion by a couple hundred votes.
And Vermilion County, Danville area, a couple hundred votes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, but I mean, I know a lot of people here locally were really campaigning hard, for Bernie Sanders, and it paid off, and everything. So I guess this leads into...
He won the bumper sticker election. The only stickers I saw for anybody was Bernie Sanders.
You know, I didn't even see a Hillary Clinton sign until yesterday, and I was driving down this one street in Champaign, and I've seen hundreds of Bernie Sanders signs. That's the first Hillary Clinton sign I've seen. But anyway, what do you think is going to happen now, Deb, as far as Bernie Sanders' campaign? I mean, the Democratic convention is in July, I believe it is,
yes,
in Philadelphia, or?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
That's correct.
And, of course, that's when the final decision is made, kind of, but not really based on the primary votes. What do you think is going to happen now between now and then in July? So basically we're looking at what, April, May, 4 months.
I believe that the campaign is picking up steam again. It's moving into territory that's more favorable to Bernie Sanders. He's popular on the West Coast. I think he's going to do very well in the Utah and Idaho caucuses, although, you know, no Democrat really has a chance in those states, but no Democrat has a chance in Mississippi, and Hillary Clinton got a whole lot of props for winning Mississippi. So, every time the point of this campaign is, yes, we would like to have Bernie Sanders as our Democratic nominee. We would like to have him as our next president. But it's bigger than that. It's about building momentum and building a progressive network across the country.
Mm-hmm. A movement, basically.
A movement. And every time Bernie Sanders opens his mouth and gives a speech, he is talking about progressive issues that would not be talked about at all in this campaign.
Mm-hmm.
He's talking about ending mass incarceration. Was that going to be talked about in this campaign? No.
Yeah.
He's talking about single-payer health care. Democrats don't want to talk about single-payer health care.
Well, the corporate Democrats
the
don't.
The corporate, yeah. Yes.
The working people, the majority of the people, yes, who support the Democratic Party do.
Yes, exactly. You know, and you bring it to a state level. You know, Illinois passed a referendum last time, overwhelming in 2014, overwhelmingly approving a raise in the minimum wage.
Mm-hmm.
And our Democratic Speaker of the House wouldn't even bring it up for a vote.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that Bernie Sanders is talking about it and pushing the issue and making people think about these issues is every time he does that, we win.
Okay.
And it builds people's expectations up. And so hopefully they will not be so satisfied or will not be satisfied with Not just the plate half full or whatever, but mm-hmm. the crumbs from the table.
Okay. Bill?
Well, and also, too, he's making Hillary Clinton say a lot of things she normally otherwise wouldn't say and
mm-hmm.
ape a lot of positions. And
not that she's serious about it, of course, yeah, based on her track record, because, again, we got to go by track record what someone's done.
But these things could always be pulled back out and – like this movement, you know, is it going to be there active between elections?
Yeah, that's the big question. I think it's a very excellent question.
Yeah, because that's the problem with the labor unions. All they do, the only political things that labor unions do is give money to Democrats, and they also give to Republicans quite often too,
mm-hmm.
and hedging their bets just like the other
corporations
side does.
Yeah.
And they call you up and tell you to vote for Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically all they do. They don't politically educate their members. I mean, it's atrocious what I hear from union members.
Mm-hmm.
It's just awful,
especially the younger members.
Yeah, and they don't. That's just it, and that's what we need. We need things between elections, and we need real political education, not just vote for our client party.
Mm. When PDA was formed in 2004, and it came out of the Dennis Kucinich campaign,
okay,
there was a lot of discussion back and forth whether Progressive Democrats of America should actually be Democrats, whether they should work for a third party, or whether they should work within the Democratic Party. What they decided was a hybrid kind mm-hmm. of strategy, working inside the Democratic Party to push the Democratic Party farther to its progressive and populist roots, and working outside the Democratic Party with issue-oriented organizations to further those issues.
Okay.
When our founder and executive director, Tim Carpenter, died in 2014, a lot of people, a lot of our donors, a lot of members, thought that PDA would fold up and die.
Mm-hmm.
Along with him, basically.
Okay.
What we did under the leadership of Connor Boylan and Andrea Miller was we went large instead.
Okay.
And now PDA stands not only for Progressive Democrats of America, which is a federal PAC, but also People Demanding Action, which is a 501c4 and can work with organizations such as Jobs with Justice, Social Security Now, Moral Mondays, church groups, and so we are working both within and outside the Democratic Party, because we don't have time to start a third party. And our opinion was that our issues are too critical, our need for progress is too critical to start from the beginning and
create something. Yeah,
yes. And so, you know, as flawed as the Democratic Party is,
mm-hmm.
Well, it's better.
It's got a structure.
You've got a vehicle to get the information out, get voters informed. And more informed voters make for better democracy, which is one reason that we have so many assaults on both education and voting rights. And I know that's a whole other.
Sure, but it does relate. You're absolutely right. Gus.
Yeah, I think that's an important point. But we do have to recognize the Democratic Party for being an incredibly pro-capitalist and an exploitative group.
Sure.
And I do appreciate the fact that what Bernie Sanders does do is that he does provide really one of the best substantial critiques of capitalism in the global corporatization phase of what we're experiencing now. So I do agree in that I think that what he's doing can actually create the next party that's going to come in. You know, so while he can't do it right now, you know, he's laying the foundation for a lot of people to start really being, you know, think reimagining something different than the Republican and Democratic Party. So regardless of whether he gets the nomination or not, he's done a profound, like, transformation to the discussion and also the beliefs and ideologies of a lot of different people
mm-hmm.
based Excellent. On the things that he is addressing. So, yeah.
And also, he's also addressed and changed the way the political discourse at the national level is taking place.
Oh, indeed.
He's running a positive campaign that is substantive and issue-based
yeah.
rather than based on name-calling and body.
Yeah, I know. Personally, I know a lot of the people feel this way that up until about recently, a lot of people thought that Bernie Sanders was being way too soft on Hillary Clinton. I mean, don't have to do name calling, but expose her for what she is based on her track record. Yeah. You know, I think that's important. That's not playing dirty politics when you tell the truth about your candidate, especially when they're lying, you know, their rear ends off about what they've done and who they are, you know.
Yeah, well,
I mean, things that they've done in the past that have actually harmed people. So, I'm sorry, Bill, go ahead.
Well, I mean, as well as that, and there's a video that you see quite often on the internet of somebody collapsing during one of his speeches, and the first he just runs right over to that person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that's just I think that says a lot right there.
Yeah. So, okay, if Hillary Clinton gets the nomination, what's the position, the official position of PDA? I mean, are they going to support her, or are they going to say, we're going to make no endorsement, or, you know, what do you think is going to happen? I mean, cause it's probably.
Our position is that mm-hmm. it's still the primary season, and when primary season is over, we'll make a determination.
Okay, all right. That's fair enough. Okay.
One of my pet peeves, and I think the pet peeves of a lot of my colleagues, is Democrats, the Democratic Party, once progressives votes,
mm-hmm.
they want our money,
oh,
they
yeah.
want our time and energy,
mm-hmm.
but they want us to keep our little mouths shut.
Well, yeah, that's just definitely not what we need, because that's a top-down system, and we've had enough of that.
And,
you know.
And I would like to say one, go back to the clean campaign
yeah.
of Bernie Sanders once again. Changing the course, the way political discourse is done is really important, both on the national and the local level.
Mm-hmm.
And we are very fortunate here in Champaign-Urbana to have had an excellent example of a substantive issue-based campaign in the two campaigns that Carol Ammons ran for
sure.
state representative in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
That was a gold standard. It brought a lot of new people in,
mm-hmm.
People who are still active, just like the Bernie Sanders campaign is bringing a lot of new people in. But what disturbs me is I watched the 2016 primary here locally, and the Democratic Party did the same thing that it was doing in 2014. It was engaging in win at all costs, the ends justify the means, resorting to name-calling and character assassination and vitriolic rhetoric,
mm-hmm.
Whisper campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the people doing it to this time were in contested local races were the same people who call themselves progressive and yet were trying to destroy Carol Ammons.
Yes.
I think we need to change the tone and tenor of political discourse
mm-hmm.
and the way campaigns are run, not only at the national level, but at the local mm-hmm. level. And it has to work its way up. Bernie understands that you have to start at the grassroots.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, those $2.70 contributions, those $27 contributions add up, as everybody can see. And people on the ground. An amazing thing about the Illinois primary is people were coming in on buses from Indiana and Wisconsin to canvass in Illinois. When has that ever happened in a presidential campaign?
Yeah, and likewise that the a lot of people from Illinois were going to Iowa.
Absolutely.
Yeah, last you know, in the fall.
Right.
Yeah, but, and talking about small donations, you can call 217-359-9338 and make a pledge now.
Okay, very good. Well, Deb, thank you so much for coming on the World Labor Hour. This has been a very interesting discussion, and I'd love to get you back then sometime after the convention and pick your brain some more about where this movement's going to go, because
okay.
This is a, I think this is a really important but also a very tricky question, if
and
you will.
And Dave,
yes.
Like you always say, we need to use all the tools in the box, right?
All the tools in the toolbox, that's
well,
correct.
Even before the convention in June in Chicago will be a progressive event mm-hmm. about the people's agenda. So,
oh, okay.
I'll get you more information.
Great, that'll be great. Okay, you've been listening to the World Labor Hour. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Those were the days we voted because we thought it mattered. And now it's all crazy. Sam is madder than a hatter, but it doesn't amaze me that the Constitution is in tatters. No, nothing can faze me, cause my mind is like pancake batter. My vision is hazy, and I'm wishing that someone would save me from going demo crazy. I'm going to demo crazy. I'm going to demo crazy.
Okay, that was Paul Kohnheimer and Darren Druda, at least a band called Theory of Everything. That song was Demo Crazy. And real quick,
Darren needs to buy some vowels for his last name.
Yeah.
If you want to look him up, it's D-R-D-A.
Okay.
And he's got some really good stuff out, and it's probably on YouTube.
Okay. All right.
Paul, too.
Calling all pledgers. We just got a great and limited prize in for two free pairs of tickets to the April 1st Mavis Staples show at the Virginia Theater. Donate today, Saturday, to be entered to win. Donate online at WFT.org or call in at 217-359-9338 or donate at the station located at 113 North Market Street in Champaign. All donations will gain one entry each into the drawing. The winner will be contacted on Monday, March 21st. And I guess Mavis Staples is both a solo vocalist with her family group, the Staples Singers. Oh, yeah. Mavis Staples has recorded everything from 1950s Delta Gospel, a sound
I'll
she helped create.
Take you there.
That's right. Okay. And civil rights era protest songs to number one hits like Respect Yourself and I'll Take
Respect
You There.
Yourself.
A dedicated collaborator, Miss Staples, has worked with producers from Prince and Ry Cooter to Wilco's Jeff Tweedy, and has performed with dozens of different recording artists, including legendary spot in the concert film The Last Waltz. 2015, Staples won the second annual Woody Guthrie Prize, given annually to the artist who best exemplifies the spirit and life's work of Woody Guthrie by speaking for the less fortunate through music, film, or other art forms and serving as a positive force for social change in America. So again, call in today, or donate online at WFT.org, and the number is 217-359-9338.
And by the way, I'll be performing at the open mic tomorrow, 3 p.m., at the West End Saloon in Bement.
Oh man,
I'll probably just be playing. I probably won't sing.
What do you play, Bill?
I don't know. These guys, it's these young people. They're like I went to school with their parents.
Yeah. So what instrument do you play?
Oh, I play guitar.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
But you know, they start playing like thrash. And
I didn't know you played a guitar. Wow, all these years, I never know that.
Huh? Amazing.
Yeah.
Bob Plesney does.
Well, okay. Now I do. So,
hey, Bob, how you doing, bud?
Okay. So, Gus, you have something on a very interesting, important woman in both African-American and women's history. Is that correct?
History in general.
Just history in general, of course, yes.
You know, there are very few people that really, you know, because I'm not, you know, everybody knows I'm anti-vanguardism. I don't believe in that type of stuff. But there are groups, there are certain people who definitely can be given the title of some of the greatest people to have ever lived for the work they did in leading people. And that honor goes to one of my favorite people, Ida B. Wells, who also was known later on as Ida B. Wells Barnett. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to do an analysis, not just on her life, but also in relation to the current political structure as well, and to actually kind of understand that Ida B. Wells is really the first one of the first interdisciplinary scholar activist to actually challenge capitalism in ways that no other person did. So, born a slave in 1862 in the middle of the Civil War, Ida B. Wells was in the forefront of the fight for black rights in the post-Reconstruction era, a time of widespread lynch rope terror when black people, although not returned to slavery, were being solidified as a race color caste at the bottom of American society. She refused to accommodate racist reaction in any way and was so... she was so antagonistic to the people like Booker T. Washington and his apologists who repudiated militant struggle against the racist status quo. The NAACP initially kept her out of its leadership and even appropriated some of her efforts while disappearing her role in the anti-lynching struggle. So you had this tendency to remove Ida B. Wells, because she was indeed a radical, remove her from the struggle against racism and to actually take her opportunities and her ideas away. So she has been kind of marginalized within the histories, and you only see her in passing in textbooks, et cetera.
Yeah. And I have to say, I consider myself a, you know, a sort of a amateur, you know, history buff. I never heard of her until about a year ago.
Well, you're pretty good at history though. You're a bit above amateur.
Well, okay. Well, thank you. But, you know, that just tells you how much they've been trying to suppress her memory and, her, you know, her works, what she did.
Exactly. So in contrast to Wells, at that time in the late 1800s, right after the Civil War and Reconstruction, Booker T. Washington was the so-called, quote, black leader whom all the white racist capitalist leaders could actually appreciate. Because coming to the fore in the 1890s, he represented pretty much a surrender to forcible segregation. Washington and his famous Tuskegee Institute, which was created to prepare blacks for menial labor, and for his Atlanta Compromise speech, which is considered one of the most controversial speeches ever given, advocated that black people work hard, accept segregation, and submit meekly to racist oppression. Washington's emphasis on industrial education appalled Ida B. Wells, who observed in the article, she wrote an article, Booker T. Washington and his critics, quote, "This gospel of work is no new one for the Negro. It is the South's old slavery practice in a new dress. It was the only education the South gave the Negro for 2.5 centuries. She had absolute control of his body and soul. The Negro knows that now and then the South is strongly opposed to his learning anything else but how to work," end quote. Wells characterized the Tuskegee's answer to lynching as, quote, "Give me money to educate the Negro, and when he is taught how to work, he will not commit the crime for which lynching is done," end quote. In her eyes, Washington ignored the fact that lynching is not invoked to punish crime, but color, and not even industrial education can change that. So, what's interesting in that idea and this, you know, this, what's going on with Booker T. Washington, we turn to today. There's something very similar in the way that President Barack Obama does a lot of his talking about race and the way Booker T. Washington does it as well. The current Democratic President Barack Obama hailed Booker T. Washington as the leader of a growing civil rights movement, and both Obama and Washington came to the fore in the periods of reaction and served well the white ruling class, in part by despicably telling black people that their ongoing oppression in this racist capitalist society is their own fault. And the reason why this is important for Ida B. Wells is that you see that she has a lot, and a lot of people don't recognize this, but she had a lot of struggle and conflict against the black middle class and other groups that were trying to stop her from going on this anti-lynching campaign and to actually call out racism for what it was, an appendage of capitalism. So they really went after her with that. So back then you had Washington and a few others. Now you have President Obama taking up the same arguments that Washington made against people like us in this radio station and other groups out there who were trying to fight against and racial oppression, where a lot of Obama's talk, when during the Baltimore Rebellion, when he talked about them being thugs and not being committing crimes, even though he doesn't understand what a rebellion is. So again, it's really important. But back to Wells. Wells represented continuity in a long line of black women who were in the forefront of the fight against slavery and then against black liberation. You think about Harriet Tubman playing a major role in laying the groundwork for black freedom in the U.S. as one of the conductors on the Underground Railroad. You think of Harriet Jacobs, who was an active abolitionist fighter who lived through the Civil War, struggled to implement the promises of radical Reconstruction. Wales grew up during Reconstruction, so she got a firsthand view of something that could have possibly turned into the second revolution. The American Revolution was the bourgeoisie revolution, but the one in terms of the working class revolution that almost happened during Reconstruction, Wales grew up during that. You know, it went through different phases, and she experienced the exhilaration of the freed slaves during those volatile years. In her youth, she came to expect full equality and refused to accept anything less. She persistently fought against the stream of reaction that was ascending after the defeat of the radical Reconstruction Republicans. That defeat gave rise to a new political alliance of big planters, Southern capitalists, and certain Northern financial interests. And Du Bois talks about this in Black Reconstruction. Investors in Southern railroads, etc., that turned their back on working class organization between Black and white workers. They literally could have set this up to be the big revolution to end capitalist exploitation, and they turned their backs on, they created the psychological wage. Wells recognized this. The civil rights struggles in the 50s and 60s resulted in real gains for Black people in the realm of so-called legal equality, yet the Black masses remain specially oppressed. So when Wells is born, the Civil War was waging in her hometown of Holly Springs, Mississippi, in Vicksburg. And those of you that know your history, Vicksburg, Mississippi was a pivotal point of the war. And the point I'm trying to make is that Wells's experiences, and we need to take this in the context when we think about how to organize and think about anti-racial or anti-racist organizing, her experiences in the Civil War and also in Reconstruction molded her radical perspective and the understanding that this is not something that we can simply reform. Lynching is not something that is done for punishment and retribution. Unionism is not something that is only for a certain group of people. These are things that affect all working people. So, and just to give a really good backstory about an incident that happened, the clash beginning on May 1st in Memphis between recently discharged Black veterans and racist mobs, mainly Irish cops and firemen, resulted in the deaths of 46 Black people. Hundreds of Black homes were also burned down. Then on July 30th, New Orleans cops, many of them Confederate veterans, the Redeemers, attacked a radical dominated constitutional convention called by the governor, intended by 25 delegates who were guarded by 200 Black supporters, many of them former soldiers. 34 Black people and 3 white radical Republicans were killed and over 100 were injured. The political tide turned towards a more radical Reconstruction, and this is when Wells starts crafting her ideas about the problems of lynching. So she puts out her first pamphlet, Southern Horrors, which she actually dispels. The biggest myth amongst Black lynching in the country during the Nadir period, which was the worst period for racial relations, the biggest myth was that Black men were raping white women and deserved to be lynched. She actually did journalistic research.
That reminds me of something Donald Trump said in his, you know, when he came out, man, Mexican rapists now.
Same stuff. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So what she did is she used journalism, she used history, and she used census data. She used all these different measures that scholars use and also activism to spread the word in Southern Horrors to prove that not only that rape myth was a myth, but also the fact that most lynchings occurred due to a labor dispute.
Really? Interesting.
Hey, I guess I was wondering, did she write on other topics?
Yeah, and that's later.
She
was focused on the anti-lynching campaign first. But the first thing she proved was that labor disputes were the number one cause for lynchings, because it was a show that there was a social control problem happening amongst the white people and the Black people in a particular area in the South. It usually happened when a sharecropper challenged the landowner, and the landowner felt that person was getting too uppity. And that would lead to a lynching or a possible pogrom. And a pogrom is what some people call a race riot. Where riot is a very depoliticized word, and it means that it's spontaneous and like people are just insane idiots who one day decide to lose their cool and kill people.
Yeah.
No, all racial violence is planned out. Most of it's planned out. So that's why I prefer the term pogrom.
Well, it quite often comes from specific incidents, and you mentioned rape, like Emmett Till. He whistled at a woman, and look, you know, exactly. And that was many, many years after Wells.
Exactly. So now
decades.
And now the next one that came out, well, not the next one, but she was also working for not just telling people to stop lynching, but she was working towards how to keep Black people to protect themselves. And that was the biggest thing. She was very much so in favor of armed self-defense. In her autobiography, she relates how she bought a pistol after Tom Moss, who she knew was lynched, because, I quote, "I expected some cowardly retaliation from the lynchers. I felt that one had better die fighting against injustice than to die like a dog or a rat in a trap. I had already determined to sell my life as dearly as possible if attacked. If I felt I could take one lyncher with me, this would be even enough to even up the score," end quote. Her pamphlet, Southern Horrors, which the New York Age published after she was driven out of Memphis because of her activism, she further stressed the importance of armed self-defense for black people, of the many inhuman outrages of this present year. This is her quote, excuse me. "The only case where the proposed lynching did not occur was where the men armed themselves. The only time an African-American who was assaulted got away has been when he had a gun and used it in self-defense of his life. The lesson this teaches, and which every African-American should ponder well, is that a Winchester rifle should have a place of honor in every black home, and it should be used for that protection which the law refuses to give." Now, this is something that we just had my advisor, Sundiata Chajua, who actually is one of the first scholars of the 21st century to write on black resistance to lynching in Decatur, Illinois.
Okay.
And he has a book out on that and a few articles as well. So like I said, this is not something new, but the fact that she's saying these things and doing these things while there's very little support from different classes in the black community, that says a lot
about
class warfare that a lot of people don't like to talk about with her. But just to end quickly, she writes two more major pamphlets. She writes Red Record, which is the international call for the humanity to stop the lynchings, and it got over really well with she went to England and a few other places to show that America should be ashamed of themselves for killing people but claiming to be democratic and free. And so that was a major part of it as well. Then she puts out Mob Rule in New Orleans, which is really the pivotal piece of resistance to lynching and kind of what happened with a man named Robert Charles, who defended his life and his family's life from the police in New Orleans and ended up killing over, I believe, 5 to 6 policemen as they tried to lynch him for a crime he did not commit.
Wow.
So, yeah, she's doing all this. The anti-lynching bill is up, and, because of her, it does end up being passed. But like Bill said, she actually starts becoming a fervent activist for unionism in the black community. She helps organize and helps the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters organize with A. Philip Randolph.
Okay.
And she becomes – this is why she's so pivotal in the labor movement, is that she's a shift from the intellectual – who did not support unionism in the black community. Because remember, the black petty bourgeoisie, they were very much anti-union across the country. She is one of those new intellectuals who actually promotes it, and you see a shift, and now after her, most of the black middle class are going to start supporting unions for African Americans, mm-hmm. because they understood it to be not just a racial issue, but a racial class issue, that capitalism and racism are tied together. And she's the one that brings that forward and a lot of it has to do with the Great Migration and other mm-hmm. stuff I don't have time to talk about today. But I just wanted people to know about Ida B. Wells and the type of work she did. She did this solely as somebody who was deeply concerned with the humanity in the country. She believed that America could be a better country if the lynchings and the other racial violence that happened stopped, and also that both working class whites and blacks unionized together to fight capitalism.
Okay.
So she believed in creating a new structure of the American society.
Okay. You said she was born sometime like during the early part of the Civil War.
1862.
Oh, okay. And when did she die?
She died in 19.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to put you on the spot. I was just kidding.
I just got, because I just put the stuff about her accomplishments.
Do you know if it was like in the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, or?
It was definitely in the late 30s.
Late 30s, okay.
Yeah, don't quote me on the date though.
So she died about around the same time as Lucy Parsons.
Have my dates.
Sure, sure. But I was just trying to get a feel of the time period, from Reconstruction.
That's March 25th, 1931.
Oh, okay, 31. Okay.
Google is your friend.
Google is your friend. Yeah. Google me this. Okay.
Well, I don't know. It might be looking over your shoulder.
Yeah. No, this is, I mean, what an incredible person. And the fact that her story has been buried, you know, intentionally, obviously, all these years. You know, that's interesting comparison between, Booker T. Washington and, you know, Barack Obama. Wow, I never even thought of that parallel, you know. Yeah. And it's interesting, when I was in grade school, so we're talking, you know, in the last part, mind you, you know, we're talking like 66, 67, or 67, 68, 69. That's the only African American history we had was about Booker T. Washington and George Washington Carver. I mean, and the guy who was killed in the African-American was killed in the Boston Massacre.
Yeah, Crispus Attucks.
Yeah, but that was the only African-American history I had until I got to middle school and I had an African-American history teacher. And then I didn't, until that point, I didn't know about, you know, even Frederick Douglass.
I mean,
you know?
There's a reason why President Obama gives accolades to Booker T. Washington, but not to Du Bois and not to Ida B. Wells.
Mm-hmm.
Because these were forward-thinking, progressive people who evolved from a basic reformist attitude to a more radical perspective
mm-hmm.
about capitalism being the brunt of racism or, mm-hmm. or creating racism and gender inequality, et cetera. Like, you know, like I said, we have to really understand what the president is there for. The president is there to maintain the status quo of the country.
Yes.
So again, the reason by him saying those things, we really need to stop looking at the president to be the savior or sayer of things that we expect from him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not going to happen. We have to understand that we have the ability to create something different when we organize ourselves and we use alternative media like Webb and the World Labor Hour.
And by the way,
call
217-359-9338. 217-359-9338. People in Piscrotum, please call in. Homer, Villa Grove, Tuscola, Muhammad.
Yeah,
Muhammad. There's probably a lot of people over there that enjoy WEFT. And anyway, we really need to keep these things going. You heard earlier, if you were listening to earlier programs, Sandra was describing an effort to a cooperative effort between WEFT and the Independent Media Center to create local news, not so much like public affairs opinion stuff like this, but some
news of the day, more or less.
News
right?
of the day.
Yeah.
Hopefully someday daily news. But folks, I tell you, I've worked in it in TV and it's a really difficult thing to pull off.
Yeah. Indeed.
But that means we're working hard and we will use your money very well.
Okay.
You know, we'll have all the best people like Donald Trump.
And,
you know, he has the best words. He has a lot of words. He actually went off on a tangent on about he has the best words.
Yeah, like
throw
him out, take him home to his mother. I mean that's ridiculous. But anyway, one last thing I want to ask real quick, Gus. George Washington Carver was he was a little younger than Booker T. Washington, but he was kind of the same kind of mindset, if you will. Is that correct?
Bootstrapper.
This is who?
George Washington Carver.
You mean Booker T?
No, I'm saying is
yeah, a scientist.
Yeah, you talking about the scientist?
Yeah. Now I don't know. I had heard that during the caller. We're not taking any calls. Please hang up.
Call 217-359-9338 and make a pledge.
Yes, that's the number you need to call. Yeah, I remember that we're talking about the meatpacking strike in Chicago mm-hmm. during the 19-teens last time. And,
yeah.
From what I was reading from, I think it was Philip Fauner in the history of that.
Oh yeah.
Was that, a lot of, the African American churches in Chicago were evenly divided between supporting the unions and, actually helping the companies bring in, strike breakers
that's
from
right.
down south. And that supposedly, George Washington Carver, actually helped, facilitate this through his foundations, and just from what you were saying today, all of a sudden that brought that into mind is that this division, you know, basically between the,
and it's clear the division comes from the fact that you have a group of people who do not have the experiences of the same class as the ones who are oppressed and struggling.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't, again, people really have to understand why class is so important and why we continue to use that term, because especially in terms of you as a person and your identity, there is a reason why people made these really radically life transforming decisions based on class. Like, When the African American sharecroppers decided and they consciously made decisions to go to certain places in the Midwest and North during the first Great Migration and the second Great Migration, there was a harsh nastiness, particularly in Chicago, from the black middle class there against them.
I just found this out last week and I was, it really shocked me, frankly.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Malcolm X really touched on this about how the upper class or African Americans thought they were so much better, and what he's touching on, you know,
that's why we have to talk about the ideology matters. You know, mm-hmm. they believed in the ideas of the petty bourgeoisie that we can ascend to the capitalist class, but the only way to ascend to said class is to oppress the other class. You know, and this is something that goes back all the way to the original abolitionist movement. And I'm not saying that all of them were like that, but many of the other African American abolitionists believe that, yes, slavery is wrong, but, you know, when you start talking about this idea of what to do with African Americans after slavery ends, many of them said that we need to assimilate them into the European culture and make them understand the ideas of capitalism. And if they don't want to, and if they don't want to do that, then they're screwed. It's not that's it. And wow. they had that type of mentality.
Wow.
But look what that did for the Cherokee. You know, the old Trail of Tears thing.
Exactly. You know,
A good point, Bill. Good point.
So I'm glad you brought that up about the Chicago meatpacking, because I think that that's one of the history that hasn't been written about as much.
There's a great movie about it.
Yeah.
I can't remember the title.
Killing Floor.
But there's a few, but there's very little, scholarly work that's been done on blacks in the meatpacking industry, and that because you see a lot of Brotherhood Sleeping Car Porter books,
sure,
and you got a few coal mining books, mm-hmm. but there's not that many on blacks in the meatpacking industry. So that's something that we need to explore more about, particularly now as unions are really struggling to fight to kind of really do something about the racial problems in a lot of unions right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
Okay, well, thanks a lot for that, Gus, and you've been listening to the World Labor Hour, listener-supported community radio station, WFT. You still have time to call in your pledge at 217-359-9338. Bill, did you find something?
Well, I don't think it's Killing Floor. I'll look it up, maybe.
Yeah, we'll have it for next week. So, stay tuned for the Union Edge. Until next week, be safe and power the people. Take care.